Knowing how to speak and understand a new language can be an invaluable tool when traveling, meeting new friends, or just even to master a new skill. But it's not always simple when you're bogged down by textbooks and structure classes. That's why so many people trust Rosetta Stone. Rosetta Stone is the most trusted language learning program, available on desktop or as an app. It truly immerses you in the language you want to learn, like Spanish, French, Italian, Chinese, and more. You won't just be studying English translations. The Rosetta Stone intuitive process helps you pick up a language naturally, first with words, then phrases, then sentences. Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/rs10. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/rs10 today.
To have two crimes committed in the same location, both women meeting violent ends, this has to be exceptionally rare. I can't put it any other way.
On the morning of February 13, 1999, 44-year-old John Carbo was at his office in the small village of Stonington, Connecticut, when his phone rings around 9 a.m. He's expecting a call from his sister Paula to confirm their lunch plans for that day. But instead, it's an officer with the Connecticut State Police who tells John he needs to get to Paula's house as quickly as possible. John rushes to nearby East Haddam, where Paula lives with her husband Robert and their son Philip.
So I get there, and it's just cars everywhere, police cars, an ambulance, and I'm going, what the hell? And I'm greeted by a police officer that tells me my sister committed suicide. My first reaction is, that's insane. That's impossible.
The idea that his sister, 43-year-old Paula Koloski, committed suicide is inconceivable to John. And as details of what happened that morning come to light, a more sinister explanation emerges. Then, almost 20 years later, a second tragic death in the same house confirms John's darkest suspicions. I'm Steve French, and this is Unsolved Mysteries, Two Dead Wives. When John Carbo arrives at his sister Paula's house and is told that she committed suicide, the first person he wants to speak to is her husband, Robert Koloski.
I got into the house and I was segregated in the kitchen and told to stay there, and that Mr. Koloski was still being interviewed. After that, maybe 20, 30 minutes after staying in there, Bob Koloski comes out. He comes drifting out. And I looked at him, and he looked at me, and this guy had a breakdown. And I've never seen anything like that in my life. This wasn't grief. This was hysteria. And he started saying some pretty odd things. Like, it's all my fault. I caused it. So that was the atmosphere that greeted me when I came over to my sister's home.
Paula's husband, Robert, tells police he left the house early that morning. He woke up around 6:30 a.m. and was out the door by about 6:45 to run errands. Paula was still sleeping when he left. And their 9-year-old son, Philip, was at his friend's house where he had stayed the night before. Robert says he went to the bank and transferred $6,000 from his savings account to his checking account. He has a time-stamped receipt confirming the transaction. When he returned home around 7:15, he heard what he thought was his wife snoring. But when he went in to check on her, he was shocked to find Paula in bed with a bullet hole in her skull and his own handgun on the bed. He immediately called 911.
For the first 48 hours, let's say, I was getting a very, very confusing picture. It was almost as if there were rumors, and somebody would say, oh, there was a fight the night before. And somebody else would say, there was a fight and there was a struggle for the gun. It was things like that that were being said. And I don't recall exactly where they were coming from, but these rumors seemed to be everywhere in the air. I just remember a sense of detachment, just a sense of, I can't believe this is happening.
In his interview with police, Robert says that Paula had recently seemed upset about a work review that had been postponed, and that she had been talking a lot about the recent passing of her mother and uncle. But then he admits, quote, "I have not heard Paula make any reference to wanting to harm herself. I did not see this coming, nor did I feel she was bothered by something," end quote. Yet Robert assumes that Paula killed herself when she was alone in the house that morning, that she found his gun and shot herself in the head. Based on Robert's statement, Paula's death is ruled a suicide. But her brother John refuses to accept that theory.
Growing up, my persona was that I had to find out things. I just had to know the truth about things. And I simply wasn't going to accept that my sister had committed suicide. And I certainly wasn't going to accept based on the evidence that was presented to me.
John and his younger sister Paula were just 2 years apart and had always been quite close. The image of her remains fresh in his mind.
Paula was about 5'5". She had brown hair. And in her youth, her hair was long and she had a Roman nose. We are half Italian and half German. And as she got into being a mother, well, the hair got cut shorter, but she was a very attractive woman. Paula and I, we were sort of in a sense like twins. I was able to be like Dennis the Menace, and my sister was the good girl. My sister got good grades and I was able to make mischief. My sister would be the person that you would want to have on your team, doing things, accomplishing things. She was a great worker, very organized, but a lot of fun. Her dinners were legendary, incredibly creative. She would make the most incredible desserts. People would wind up taking pictures of the desserts. Let me tell you, getting an invitation to her dinners was a real honor.
Paula is in her early 20s and working as an agent at Aetna Insurance when she meets Robert. At the time, he has a job stocking vending machines, and Paula's office is on his route. He introduces himself as Robert Cornish, a music school graduate of Central Connecticut State University, and tells Paula that his vending machine job is only temporary until he can find work in the music industry. They start dating, and before long, they're talking seriously about marriage. But those plans are suddenly put on hold when Paula discovers that Robert has been lying about his identity. His last name isn't really Cornish, it's Koloski. And there's another problem. He can't legally marry Paula because he's already married to another woman. But Paula eventually forgives Robert for his lies, and they're married in April of 1980, after the divorce from his first wife is final.
At that time, I was consumed with my own direction in life. I really wasn't plugged into their relationship until the point where he had deceived my sister as to his identity. And at that point, I became pretty engaged. I would actually spend a great deal of time with them, but really it was I would spend time with my sister. Mr. Koloski was sort of like a piece of furniture that you sort of navigated around to have a relationship with my sister. I must say, I did not have a personal relationship with Mr. Koloski at all.
At the time of her death, Paula has a close relationship with her son, Philip, a full-time job, and she's also about to graduate with a bachelor's degree in business from the University of Hartford. Paula has big plans for her future, and John is surprised when a couple days before her death, she casually mentions that those plans might include divorcing Robert. She says she'll explain when they have lunch on Saturday, but by lunchtime, Paula's dead.
Paula was married for 19 years, and the thing about Paula's marriage was that it appeared to be a perfect marriage. They appeared to be the perfect couple. So when my sister mentioned that she wanted a divorce, I was completely shocked. I had absolutely no idea that the couple was in the shape that they were in. Following my sister's death, I got a hold of her hard drive and I read a lot of her papers, journals, about how she was feeling about herself and how she was feeling about her life. And my feeling of reading about her was that she was a woman who was coming to recognize that she had more talent than she had originally ever realized, and that maybe she was shorting herself.
Paula never got the chance to explain why she wanted to end her marriage, but John suspects it had to do with a rumor that her husband was having an affair with her son's babysitter, Sandra.
My sister was going to college, finishing her degree, and Sandra was the babysitter when my sister was in college. So she would come over twice a week and she would take care of Philip for dinner or whatever. And I think a relationship developed between her and Mr. Kolosky. Her marriage at the time was quite abusive, and I think they struck up a relationship. This goes back to 1997, and my mother had come upon Sandra and Mr. Kolosky in some intimate embrace. My mother had disclosed her belief that Bob and Sandra were having an affair. My sister did not take that very well. I think she was in a great deal of denial about that. And after that disclosure, my mother went on to develop the illness of cancer. And so the concern about his affair subsided due to my mother's illness taking forefront.
The last time John spoke to Paula, she sounded upbeat and positive about her life. He feels committing suicide would have been the last thing on her mind.
I am a licensed marriage and family therapist, and I do a fair amount of couples work and individual work. I've worked with people that are suicidal. When somebody commits suicide, there's always a context. It just doesn't come out of nowhere. Paula had a very close, loving relationship with her son. Paula had just been given a bonus at work, and she was slated for advancement at work. We had plans of getting together that Saturday, the Saturday that she died. And the day before my sister died, she goes to the dentist. All of those behaviors are inconsistent with somebody who's contemplating suicide. Another oddity, my sister hated guns. My sister had no knowledge of this gun. She had never fired the gun. And this gun would have required that my sister put a magazine of bullets in the gun, and then she would have had to pull the bolt back so that the bullet would load into the chamber. And for somebody who has absolutely no knowledge of guns, that to me was a real oddity. Everything about her death makes no sense statistically. Women, by and large, do not use a gun to kill themselves. Women will use pills. Why? Because women want to preserve their vanity. Women who have children, by and large, do not commit suicide because their children act as an insulating function. In other words, they have something to live for. So all the conditions that would support a suicide don't exist here.
Hey, Unsolved Mysteries listeners. I'm here to tell you that there's no reason to panic the next time you're searching for the perfect gift. Now you can use Gift Mode on Etsy. Gift Mode on Etsy takes the stress out of gifting, so you can find the perfect item for anyone and any occasion. It's easy. Just tap or click Gift Mode on your Etsy app or Etsy.com. Then answer a few short questions about who you're shopping for and what they like. And Gift Mode instantly gives you curated gift ideas based on hundreds of personas. There's a lot of pressure around gifting. I usually have a hard time thinking of gift ideas for family members, and sometimes I get super stressed trying to find the perfect thing. But now with Gift Mode on Etsy, I can search hundreds of gifting personas and find so many incredible items. And I actually just found the perfect gift for my fitness fanatic sister. Now it's simple to find gifts made by independent sellers for all the people in your life. So whether you need a housewarming gift for the new homeowner or a birthday present for the pickleballer, Gift Mode has you covered. Need to find the perfect gift? Don't panic. Try Gift Mode on Etsy now.
I actually didn't know what I was doing. I just sort of bumbled into this. More and more and more, I kept asking questions and I kept doing reenactments in my mind. Nothing made sense here. After I got the police reports, it made even less sense.
1 year after Paula's death, John requests the police file for Paula's case and spends hours combing through every detail.
When you begin to read Kolosky's police report, you begin to realize that there's too many moving parts and things just don't line up. For example, he reports that he's hearing breathing sounds that he describes as snoring sounds, and he's pinpointing locations in the house where he's hearing these sounds, as if my sister is still alive. So we're now requested to believe that this woman is alive with a gunshot wound to the temple for 45 minutes. That's impossible. The suicide theory was basically that there was blood on her hands, and then when you look at the autopsy pictures, there's not enough blood on her hand that supposedly was the shooting hand. There's hardly any blood on it. There was evidence that was collected that was never processed. And one of the pieces of evidence had to do with gunshot residue. And so what we discover is that there's hardly any gunshot residue on my sister's hands. And there should be, but there isn't. So it was things like that that led me to believe my sister never did this. And it seems the more and more I asked questions, the more and more evasive the police got. The police, right from the very beginning, they treated me basically as if I was a distraught family member who wasn't going to accept reality. But I wasn't going to accept their version of reality. And I can just say the more I asked questions, the more I got put off, which really kind of upset me, which really kind of fueled me to go forward here.
Hoping to reignite his sister's case, John hires attorney Michael Malchick, a former detective for the Connecticut State Police.
Mike had solved all these cold cases, something like 12-0. I mean, incredible. He had said to me basically that most grieving people are not looking at the information correctly, but he'll take a look at the case. And I met him on a Friday and he said, I'll get back to you on a Monday. And that evening, that Friday evening, he says, we need to talk. And from there, we began to develop a case.
Mike agrees with John's assessment that many aspects of the case warrant re-examination. Mike believes that the best chance of overturning the suicide ruling and reopening the case is to remove Robert Kolosky as executor of Paula's estate and then file a wrongful death lawsuit against him. Judge Paul Buell of the Connecticut Probate Court for the District of East Haddam is assigned to preside over the hearing.
I was a judge for a total of 16 years. I was 7 years into it, and this one, when I forget every other case, maybe when I forget everything else that ever happened in my life, I'll probably remember this. It just stood out from all the others. You know, my initial reaction when I got the file and the claim was, this can't be happening in East Haddam, Connecticut. These things are supposed to happen on true crime shows on television, not here.
John and his legal team don't need to prove their wrongful death claim. They just need to demonstrate to Judge Buell that the claim has some basis in fact in order to remove Robert as executor. Robert hires attorney Avram J. Sprecher to defend his position as executor. Avram is a specialist in criminal defense and plaintiff's personal injury.
wherever there are family members involved, violent deaths involved, and of course a suicide is a violent death, you have significant emotional involvement by parties. You can imagine family members who feel that she was killed, and Mr. Kowalski, who obviously denied that and had been married with this lady for almost 20 years, that alone breeds a great deal of emotionalism on both sides, and some animus, to say the least, on both sides.
As arguments are presented, three key factors take center stage in Judge Buell's mind. The first is a series of police photographs that show how Paula's body was found the morning of her death.
The pictures showed Paula Kowalski lying dead on her bed, flat on her back. The head was not on a pillow or anything. The body was flat on the mattress. There was a visible entrance wound in her right temple, and there was a large stream of dried blood, about as wide as two fingers, coming out of that entrance wound. But the problem was the blood was going sideways. And what I mean by that is the blood should have flowed toward the floor, but instead it was flowing parallel to the floor and then disappeared under the collar of her pajamas.
The second factor comes from a questionable statement in Robert's sworn testimony.
He had testified that when he left to go to the bank and the gas station, his wife had been snoring. And he also testified that when he came back, he continued to hear her snoring. And he testified that he heard no gunshots. So the obvious implication of that would be that if she did kill herself, she fired the shot when he was out of the house. But what I couldn't get my hands around was that this bullet wound entered the right temple, came out through the left temple. So it passed through the center line of the brain. And 95% of people who get shot in the head, as I understand it, die pretty much almost instantly. And, you know, to take a bullet through both lobes of the brain and still be breathing for, say, 10 minutes just doesn't make any sense.
Avram Sprecher disagrees, citing various medical experts who say the sounds that Robert claims he heard are not uncommon in gunshot wounds to the head. Judge Buell's final consideration centers around Robert's alleged affair with Sandra as a possible motive for murder.
If Mr. Kowalski was involved in an affair, which it appears that he was, and he wanted to marry this woman, Sandra Kowalski, which he did, he was going to have to get divorced. And the way divorce works, especially because he was going to go into court as the bad guy who caused the breakup of the marriage, it was likely that she was going to get the house. And while they would probably get joint custody of their son, it was likely that the son would be spending most of his time at the house with his mother. Paula Kowalski had worked at an insurance company in Hartford for 20 years and had dutifully made her 401k contributions every pay period. That amounted to hundreds of thousands of dollars in retirement savings, which she was most likely going to get to keep in a divorce proceeding. And there was also, although life insurance, I knew there was life insurance, I did not know the amount, but and I later found out it was apparently a fairly significant amount, hundreds of thousands of dollars again. So that, to my mind, set up a very real motive for murder, because if Paula Kowalski were to die, rather than getting divorced, he would get the house, he would have sole custody of his son, he would inherit her retirement savings, receive her life insurance. Everything would be his under the terms of the will, and he'd be free to get married again.
With all the evidence laid before him, Judge Buell issues his ruling. He finds basis in the facts of John Carbo's claim, and Robert Kowalski is removed as executor of Paula's estate. Robert Kowalski's attorney, Avram Sprecher, strongly disagrees with the ruling.
I believe that Mr. Kowalski did not have anything to do with Mrs. Kowalski's death. I spoke with the medical examiner, and he explained that this is not uncommon in this type of case, that families have great resistance to accepting a suicide determination. But I can tell you that from my experience in other firearms cases and the facts that I have seen here, the evidence of anything but suicide is not there, has never been established. All the individuals who are scientists in the sense of doctors, criminalists, all have concluded this was a suicide, and that's pretty strong evidence.
With Robert Kolosky removed as executor of his sister's estate, John can now move forward with his wrongful death lawsuit against Robert. But it will be years before the case comes to trial.
So our case was like a war, and it was battle after battle, motion after motion, discovery after discovery. I mean, it was a very long slog, and I was an active participant.
One key victory for John in his pursuit of justice is a revised cause of death ruling from the medical examiner.
The medical examiner had indicated to us that he had made the determination of suicide based on an impression given to him by the police that she was depressed. And we helped him to understand that she was not depressed. So when the medical examiner realized that my sister was not depressed, he changed this to undetermined.
John continues to uncover information about Robert Kolosky that explains why he would have wanted Paula out of his life.
Mr. Kolosky was in horrible financial shape. He owed approximately $194,000 in debt. $174,000 was credit card. They were all cash advances. And the month before she passed away, the couple had withdrawn $30,000 from two mutual funds. And she took control of the checkbook. Prior to that, Mr. Kolosky had written all the checks. I think that there was a growing awareness on my sister's part that she was in big financial trouble, that things were not as she had believed them to be. And I think my sister honestly stumbled upon something. I have no idea what she stumbled upon. I have a suspicion she may have threatened to leave Mr. Kolosky, and I think he was going to lose everything.
After 4 exhausting years of building his case, John Carbo's wrongful death claim against Robert Kolosky is finally set for trial in May of 2005. Then, on the morning of jury selection, a settlement is reached. Robert agrees to pay $75,000 to Paula's son, plus $15,000 in legal fees. But the settlement does not involve any admission of guilt on the part of Robert Kolosky.
The goal of the wrongful death lawsuit was to really engage the authorities to take the case very seriously. We were hoping for an arrest for a prosecution. That was the ultimate goal. We were able to get the case open. We succeeded in that. But I don't believe that the police really wanted to investigate it.
In John's view, the lawsuit played an important role in preserving the memory of his sister.
My lawyers did a wonderful, wonderful job of expressing my sister and giving voice to her. What was healing about it was the confrontation, that my sister was confronting Mr. Kolosky. There was something in that confrontation that I felt was healing.
John is unable to motivate the police to further investigate the death of his sister. He does his best to move on with his life. Then, on March 23rd, 2018, almost 20 years after Paula's death, tragedy strikes at the Kolosky home once again.
I think my first thought was, here we go again.
Shopping can be a lot of fun, right? But you know what else is fun? Saving money. And Rakuten is the smartest way to save money when you shop. Get cash back at over 3,500 stores across every single category, including fashion, beauty, electronics, home essentials, travel, dining, and so much more. You're already shopping at your favorite stores, so why not be saving while you're doing it? It's a no-brainer. Shop brands like Macy's, Bluemercury, Petco, Nike, Urban Outfitters, Neiman Marcus, and so much more. Here's how it works. The stores pay Rakuten a commission for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the commission with its members. You get paid via check or PayPal quarterly. Maximize your savings by stacking cash back on top of other deals like store sales and coupons. Rakuten has 17 million members who are already saving. Why not join them? Membership is free and it's easy to sign up. Cashback rates change daily. Start all your shopping at Rakuten.com or get the Rakuten app and start saving today. Your cash back really adds up with Rakuten, R-A-K-U-T-E-N.
Soon after Paula's death in 1999, Robert Kolosky marries his son's former babysitter, Sandra, the woman with whom he is rumored to be having an affair. Almost 20 years later, in 2018, Robert and Sandra still live in the same house where Paula died.
3 days after state police responded to a suspicious death in East Haddam, the medical examiner tonight saying a woman there was murdered. Police found the victim dead last Friday evening in her home on North Moodus Road. She has been identified now as 56-year-old Sandra Kolosky.
What I know about Sandra's death is that there was what appeared to be a burglary with the back door being broken into. She was bludgeoned in her bed. Sometime in the morning, as the story began to emerge, I began to see the similarities between my sister's death and her death. Mr. Kolosky is out of the house working or running errands, and he comes home and he finds his wife dead, which is exactly what happened in my sister's situation. So essentially, it's the same crime with a different method. I find it incredibly odd that we have two wives married to the same gentleman that meet violent deaths in the same location at, relatively speaking, the same time. I find that incredibly rare, and I don't understand why other people don't necessarily find it as shocking as I do. The first thing I did was I emailed the police and I offered all of my files to them. And I offered in any way I possibly could to assist them. I heard back maybe 2 weeks later, and we had a few conversations on the phone, but I've never been formally interviewed by the police.
John follows the reports of Sandra's murder and learns that at the time of her death, the Kolosky home was in foreclosure, suggesting that Robert was once again in dire financial trouble. 5 days after Sandra Kolosky is beaten to death, Robert files a claim for her life insurance.
Sandra had a pension, a 401k, a Social Security, life insurance, and also Sandra's mother had passed away 2 weeks before she did. So Sandra's estate had lots of assets from what I heard. So in my sister's case, we're forced to believe that a rational woman with everything to live for is going to kill herself. In Sandy's case, we're forced to believe that robbers will enter her house in the morning and kill her by means of bludgeoning her. In both situations, the women die violently in their bed. In both situations, he's out of the house. And in both situations, the narrative is ridiculous, absolutely ridiculous. The narratives don't make any sense. Quite honestly, at this point, I believe that the entire file case needs to be referred to the FBI. I honestly think another pair of eyes is needed, a fresh approach is needed. We're going on 3 years here since Sandra's death. If they have not found the suspect in almost 3 years, I'm not sure they're going to solve the case.
No one has been named as a suspect in the death of Paula Kolosky or the murder of Sandra Kolosky. Robert was denied Sandra's life insurance payment, and it was split between family members. For his part, John feels he's done his best to gain justice for Paula, that his 5-year journey through the police reports and court proceedings has all been worthwhile.
I don't live with a sense of needing justice. I mean, that would be nice, but I don't live with that as a goal. For me, knowing the truth of the matter has been more important. I mean, I personally believe Mr. Kolosky is in his own hell, and I wouldn't want to be in that hell. And I think he's gotten away with nothing. The true value of any choice you make is knowing what you know now, would you make the same choice again? Absolutely. No regrets. My sister would be very proud of me, and I am assured one day we'll meet and we'll have a tender embrace.
If you have any information about the deaths of Paula or Sandra Kolosky, please contact the tip line at the Connecticut State Police, Eastern District Major Crime Squad, 860-896-3237, or go to unsolved.com. Next on Unsolved Mysteries.
She told people before she died that she was scared of dying in a fire. She told someone, if somebody kills me, go look for this person. That happened just weeks before. I don't know why she said that, but she did. She was very fearful.
Unsolved Mysteries is a production of Cosgrove Muir Productions and Cadence 13. It is executive produced by Terry Dunn-Muir and Chris Corcoran. Produced by Lloyd Lockridge, Christine Lennig, Courtney Ennis, Paige Heimson, and Paul Yates. The story producer for this episode was Molly Ryan, and it was edited by Ryan Dan. From Cadence 13, editing, mixing, and mastering by Chris Basil, Andy Jaskowitz, and Bill Schultz. Production support by Sean Cherry and Ian Mont. Artwork and design is by Kurt Courtney. Publicity by Josephina Francis and Hilary Schuff. The original theme music was composed by Gary Malkin and Michael Boyd. Thanks for listening to episode 16 of Unsolved Mysteries.